To support our work at the Izzy and Mortada Picture Show and the work of other independent creators like us, sign up to listen to the podcast on Nebula. Nebula is the creator-owned streaming platform that hosts great videos and podcasts like the one you're listening to now. Sign up today at nebula.tv/picture show, and you will get access to this podcast plus other great podcasts and videos. Sign up at Nebula and help support independent media creators. That's nebula.tv/picture show.
Are you ready?
Yep.
Hi, I'm Mortada.
And I'm Izzy.
And this is the Izzy and Mortada Picture Show. In the lull before the Oscars, we have a special episode. We asked you, the listeners, for questions, and we're so happy you sent us so many. So we're actually going to have an all readers' questions episode. It's fantastic. Yep. People are listening, Izzy.
I know. It's going to be great. Although, I will say, some of the questions I think have been answered in some other episodes.
Yes.
if, for example, you were curious about what we think about Poor Things or other films that have come out recently, please do look through the archive of our episodes because you might find answers to some of the questions.
Totally. We could just point that episode.
Exactly. Exactly. But we do appreciate that you want to know what we think.
Yes.
About some of these things.
Yeah. That's why we do this every week.
Yep. Mortada, I'm going to start off with kind of a big one, I think, actually. But someone specifically wanted to hear from you about this. So I'm going to toss it to you for the first question.
All right.
This person said, I would love to hear about Mortada's favorite queer films and the state of queer cinema now.
Oh, wow. That is a big question.
It's a big question, but I feel like you know this better than anyone.
Yeah. So the state of queer cinema actually is amazing. I think is amazing. Every year, and I'm just starting the process now for Newfest. As some of you might know, I work as a curator for Newfest, which is the New York City LGBTQ plus film festival. And we usually start our process around this time. We open for submissions. And every year, two things happen. I go to Sundance and you see some amazing queer films there. And you're like, okay, it's good. The state of queer film is good. The submission's open. And from now until we announce sometime in August, I'm just watching queer films from all over the world. And there is a lot of amazing work, always every year, especially in documentary and short, in international narrative, from places like Brazil, from Nigeria, from places in Europe, like Germany has a lot of amazing queer films, Eastern Europe, France is always but I'm also happy to see, you know, like last year we had All the Colors Are Between Black and White, which was the first LGBTQ film from Nigeria. And Brazil does amazing work in queer film. So where I think queer film is lacking is the United States, unfortunately. There are a lot of amazing American documentaries and short films. But narrative film in the US, in my opinion, is sort of still hung up in identity. In like, I'm queer, I'm a lesbian, I'm a queer brown person, or I'm a queer black person. And that's where they're stuck. And I'm like, okay, but that's just the start of the conversation. What else? What else is your movie about? What else is the story you want to tell? So this is a challenge. But I see, you know, filmmakers who are up and coming, who are making shorts, do amazing work. And the shorts are always such an amazing, for me as a curator, to see new talent and sometimes talent that has been working for years, but in other mediums, who were writers or podcasters or, you know, work behind the scenes. And suddenly after years of experience, they make a small short. And all of those are amazing, and that gives me hope for the future of queer film.
Your answer reminds me of that answer Todd Haynes gave recently, where he was like, I'm not interested if it's like just queer for queer's sake, or like it needs to say something else.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know. It was in Vulture. I'm poorly paraphrasing it, but
I think that's what he said, and I agree with him 100%. And I think so if somebody wants recommendations, I'm happy to send you a lot of recommendations about queer films that have played in the festival that I have seen that we weren't able to bring to New York for a reason or another, but they are out there. There are a lot of great films. And I think this year Sundance gave us a couple, like there is a movie called In the Summers, which is actually won the Grand Jury Prize. And that one of the main characters in it is queer, but it's also just a movie that sort of like, celebrates the alternative choices of people, which is, so it's a queer narrative or lens, if you say, even if it not all the characters are identify as queer in it.
So we'll move on to the next question, which is tips for hosting a 10 out of 10 Oscar party.
I'm the worst at this.
Many of my closest friends have not seen my apartment. Like, I never host anything, and that's because I'm bad at it. So I can't answer this question.
So we hosted a couple. We usually have at least a friend or two sometimes come to watch whatever. But usually the host in this scenario is my husband, Philip. I'm just sitting there watching the show. Philip knows what food to prepare, what amazing drinks to do. So I can't really say anything, except the one thing I will say, invite friends who will not speak during the speeches. Make sure they are all on that page and there is no conversation.
I have a hard time with Oscar parties. Like, I really feel like I have to tell myself I'm either like not going to pay attention at all, or I need everyone to shut up. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, I went to a Oscars party thing at Nighthawk last year, which was really, really fun, because I sort of put myself in the mindset, like, this is a party. And so it's just like a night to have fun and not really take anything seriously. But other times I'm like, no, I need to pay, like, I need to know what's happening. I need to know what's going on. And if everyone could stop talking, that would be awesome. But then I feel like such a party pooper, so it's like tough. I think
I mean, I've been to parties and I've had people in where we're all on the same page, we want to listen to every single thing that's happening in the show, and you kind of talk during the commercial break, so I think it can be done.
Yes, totally. It's a hard balance to strike, for sure.
But another tip, maybe just make it fun, like have a competition. Also, the easiest competition is like just let people predict and guess. So that's easy. And maybe
bingo cards are fun.
Yes, bingo cards. It's another one. You had a great bingo. So use Izzy's. I'm not sure if you're going to make one this year, but if you do, our listeners can use your bingo card.
I know. I'm sure there's some pretty obvious things we could put on there for sure. Okay, if you were to host a movie night or a movie theater event, what would it be like? I feel like you have some experience with this, because you kind of do host events.
Yeah, I do. Didn't we have, I thought I saw another question that asked for a double bill. Is there a question like that? Maybe I can answer
there
them
might
together.
Be,
Something about a queer night or a campy night, maybe. I think there was a question like that. So thank you to both these questions, and I'm just going to answer them together. And then Izzy, you tell me what you will do. I will do a camp. We know every word of this movie. Let's talk back to the screen and watch Bette Davis, John Crawford, Judi Dench, and Cate Blanchett. And it's a double bill of Notes on a Scandal and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Because I think they are thematically in conversation with each other, even though they're how many years apart? 40, 45 years apart. Four amazing actresses who we love. And I personally know every single line of both those movies. Because I've watched them a million times, each one of them. And I think there are a lot of people who know every single line, especially the big scenes. And so I think that would be fun. It will be fun. It will be queer. It will be camp. And it will be all of those things.
Right, right. I would do something similar. I don't think I would. I'm not at this point interested in doing anything too serious. Like, I would want it to be kind of fun and silly. Yeah. One of my favorite theater going experiences in New York is the Mamma Mia sing along at Syndicated.
Yeah.
That is just so fun because nobody's there to really like take it seriously. You just want to scream ABBA as loud as you can.
Yeah.
And so I would want to do something like that. So I would think it would be some kind of musical or similar to what you said. I think Mommy Dearest was a really fun one. I did one. I think Head of Lettuce.
Yeah, yeah, Head of Lettuce. I don't know.
Occasionally.
Yeah.
So if I could just give people like that money, like funny people money, yeah, to just commentate, yeah, then I would do, yeah, that.
We can do a series. We can do all those movies plus the ones I mentioned, and let's do a series. Head of Lettuce, if you're listening,
yes,
call us,
please.
Email us.
Here's one from Dan Simpson, who's Eyebrow Cinema on YouTube. If you all have watched his stuff before, if you haven't, I highly recommend. His question is, as public creators, how do you balance audience expectations with your own passions and interests?
Do you want to answer that?
I wish I knew. I wish I had an answer. I don't know. I think it's harder because sometimes one of the things I've tried to do with my YouTube channel is like stay true to myself, which is that like if I'm interested in it, that's what I'm going to give priority because I'm never going to be the only person who's interested in something.
Totally.
But I also have to realize that like I may not be the only person, but there may certainly be less of us who is more interested in any given thing than like whatever the thing is people are talking about. In the past, I've given more priority to my own interests, but I'm starting to realize like now that I'm doing this full time, I need to be a little more ruthless about my decision making and think more about what is literally going to pay my rent than indulging myself. And so like I wish those things were, the Venn diagram was like a circle that I could indulge myself with things I totally love, but I think I'm just going to have to be a little more smart about that going forward, which sucks to like admit that you're not, you know, 1,000% enthusiastic about everything that you want to talk about. But, I think just finding a nice balance is, I'm thinking more about the balance these days.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I kind of, actually, my answer to this question is that I mostly don't think of audience expectations because in my work as a critic, I don't, because I'm basically write about
the
movies.
That's the job.
That's the job. So I write about the movies that they want me to write about, and then I say my opinion. So there is no audience expectation there. As a curator, I have to think of the audience because I'm curating for them. And that's where I do something the same that you do, which is, you know, if I love this movie, somebody else would love it. And sometimes even if sometimes you do things like, you know, you love a movie and you know that maybe this movie is a little niche or whatever. But there are ways of playing that film or making sure it gets seen, you know, in the way you talk about it and all of those things. So that's kind of what I think about. But the other thing is we have this podcast where we don't have to think about audience expectations and where we do what we want, basically, because this is a volunteer job that Izzy and I do every week because we love to talk to each other and we want to talk to people and talk about film. We haven't made any money out of it yet. So give us 5 stars, tell your friends. But also, you know, we know what our audience in this podcast wants to listen to us talk about the Oscars. And those are the episodes that get the most listens, but we also want to do other things. So there's a week where I talk to Lena Swalem about her amazing film Bye Bye Tabaria, where you talk to Pamela Hutchinson about The Red Shoes. And these are people who are working and moving the culture in interesting ways and doing interesting work, and people should listen to them. So maybe somebody who wants to listen to the Oscars can come to our podcast and then hear about these people in the culture who are doing amazing work, and then maybe find their work, support their work, watch their movies, you know, if they're curating, because we had a few curators and writers, find the book, find the exhibition, whatever it is. And so I think this podcast is an oasis where we don't have to think as much of audience expectations. We love you, but we are doing this kind of for ourselves. And it's fun that so many people are coming along for the ride.
Right. Do you have any favorite scores or soundtracks from the Best Picture films?
This year or in general?
I'm going to say this year. Are there any others that you like?
This year, I think the one that comes to mind is The Zone of Interest, although I don't know that. But I have an answer from like a movie from several years ago. 2014 was a year of very good soundtracks, and there are two that I listen to all the time, and I write to those soundtracks. You know, and it doesn't reflect, I love one of these movies and don't love the other one, but the soundtracks are amazing, the score. So it's The Theory of Everything, amazing score, one of my favorites ever. So nice to write to and just, you know, put it on and let everything in the background and you're just zoning in to do it. And The Grand Budapest Hotel, that's the other one.
Nice, nice.
Do you write to any?
I can't write to music because I want to listen to it. And then it's like very distracting to me.
Yeah.
But you know what I've actually started listening to, which is like a little embarrassing, but it's really working for me, is I listen to people draw, like ASMR, people like drawing or writing.
Yeah.
Because then I feel like I'm at a library.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But it's like tricking my mind into being like, everybody else is working, so get to it, you know?
Yeah.
So that is kind of embarrassing, and my YouTube algorithm is so weird. That's what I listen to when I work.
I love it.
I agree with you. I think Zone of Interest was the best score this year. I will say, I thought Oppenheimer's score was like actively really bad, and I'm shocked that people really like it. Or maybe it's not even so much the composition. I think the way it's woven into the film is obnoxious. Like, it's very present all the time and really loud.
Yeah, and loud usually wins, so no wonder it's winning all the awards.
Yeah.
I don't even remember it. So, I mean, I've seen that movie in July, so I don't remember the score. But nothing has, like, I have to say, since those two that I work to, like, nothing has really caught my, I think Shape of Water has an interesting soundtrack from a Best Picture winner from the last few days, just as a piece of music.
I do listen to a lot of scores, though, like, in general, just like in an Uber or on the train or whatever. I've been listening to a lot of Italian scores because I made that playlist for The Godfather. Like I make playlists on Spotify that correspond to a video that I make. So I made one that's like mostly Italian scores. And it's like a lot of Ennio Morricone and like Nino Rota and stuff like that, which I love, like obsessed with that.
So check out that list if you're listening.
You want those something are all
to work to.
Yeah, those are all on my Instagram, all the playlists, if you want to listen to those. Okay. Movies that you know are flawed, but you love regardless.
I mean, what is flawed? If I like it, I don't think it's flawed. That's kind of my
Well, also,
thinking.
It's like, what movie isn't flawed? Do you know what I mean? Like, you can find anything to quibble with anything.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, I
like Mamma Mia is that for me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think if this, because when people say stuff like that, and this is not the person who asked this question at all, just in general in the culture. So whoever asked this question, this is not questioning your question, but people will say like a guilty pleasure, right? And like, if it's pleasurable, why is it guilty? Is it just because this movie is maybe about women? Maybe it's campy a little bit. Maybe it's not like serious with a capital S, about a serious topic. And so I think the examples I used earlier of those two movies, Baby Jane and Notes on a Scandal, like, those I think are fantastic movies. And both of them top-notch performances, good movies, amazing screenplays, like as cinema they work. But people think of them as second rate, as campy, as like fun movies maybe for the gays and the women. And so could be flawed, but I see them as perfect. So I guess that's my answer. If I like it, it's not flawed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly how I feel. Yeah, same answer. Where it's, I think like if movies can serve different functions for you, I don't go to Mamma Mia when I'm looking for, I don't know, May, December.
Totally.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like it's doing different things for me. And so that's what that is. I think one movie maybe that kind of works for this for me is A Foreign Affair, which is a Billy Wilder movie that doesn't really get a lot of attention because it's kind of like made smack dab in the middle of a lot of his like excellent films. But I think it's like super incisive and like a biting commentary on America's post-war behavior in Berlin. And I love it. And it doesn't really get a lot of respect or, I guess, attention. So that's the only reason I'm putting it in this category.
Yeah. You know, that reminded me of another film about Germany, The Good German, the Soderbergh, Cate Blanchett, George Clooney movie. I love that film. But it has such a bad reputation. It was like a major flop. Critics hate it. Everybody hates it. And it's an because they were doing like a pastiche of Casablanca, which didn't work for people. I'm like, why do Casablanca? And Cate is, you know, I watched it for Cate Blanchett's performance. She's doing like a Ingrid Bergman / Marlene Dietrich kind of inspired performance. Like you can see the references in every move she makes on screen. And also you see the references in every shot that Soderbergh sort of comes up with and frames the actors and everything. So it's a good, I like it for that, that it's sort of like an academic film. If you love movies from that era, go watch it and, you know, compare.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have any obsessions outside of film?
Do I have time? You know, I'll answer this question in a funny way. So you said you on YouTube, you watch drawing videos, right?
I listen to them.
You listen to them. Okay. So I, after a full day of working on this job, which requires that I watch a lot of movies and think about them all day long, I do not want to watch something to relax, something that will make me think. So I watch on YouTube video videos of planes taking off and landing. There is so many
That's
of these
awesome.
Videos. And some of them are live. People will go to Heathrow or LAX or JFK or whatever and find the place by the runway and just put their cameras and just follow flights up and down. This is landing. This is go. This is flying. And it's very relaxing. And you don't have to think about anything. It's just planes. Nothing's going to happen except they're going to land or take off. And that's it.
Do they use the audio of the plane or is it like, do they dub it with music?
No, they use the audio of a plane. Some of them have commentary, which is like, sometimes I don't want to listen to the commentary. So I'll just put them without sound. And sometimes I'll listen to the commentary if it's like just, I don't know, Swiss Air from Zurich and United from Chicago, which is just what you want to hear too. It's, again, nothing that makes you think.
Wow. I love that. I mean, I'm kind of the same. It's like the thing outside of film that I want to think about is like, I don't need to think about this at all. It's very straightforward, which is for me, that's soccer.
Yes. Yeah.
I watch a lot of soccer.
Yeah.
And so, but that's why, I mean, it is, I like to sell it to people, as like, it's like the world's best reality show, but like most straight guys who watch it, like don't realize that it is, but that's what it is. It's a reality show, where, you know, you just kind of like fall in love with some of the characters and learn to hate some of the other characters and you just dislike people because they are on this team and so that's enough, you know. It's very silly. And it's all very like brain off. You're just watching people run around and then you get really excited because someone kicked a ball into a net.
Yes, it is exciting.
It's very fun.
I love soccer too. Every 4 years, just the World Cup.
Right. And I think that's totally fair. I'm completely corrupted in watching it all day, all the time. So, alas. This one is for me. Will you ever make a video about the 1951 Best Actress race? And yes, I will. I actually do plan to do that this year. I feel like I've teased it like 7 times, but as I said earlier, I need to be a little more conscientious of audience interest.
Yes.
And for a long time I avoided that because it's very intimidating because everybody wants it. But now I'm just kind of like, I need to do it. I've been thinking kind of long term about when that is going to happen. I would put it in either summer or early fall, just based on what I know my schedule is going to look like. So it is coming, and I'm promising that now. And you can all be mad at me if I don't do it, but I will do it.
So 1951, that's the film year of 1950. So this is the All About
right.
Eve.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I was like, at first I was like, 1951, what's special about that? But then I realized what it is.
Right. Yeah, I've been bad about it. Okay. Are you watching Capote and the Swans? Which 90s film? Oh, this is two questions. So I'll just start with this. Are you watching Capote and the Swans?
I am. I actually just started it this week and I watched, I don't know, whatever's available, the 4 or 5 episodes. It's good. I like it so far. I think I wasn't expecting the ladies to be outshone by the man playing Capote, but Tom Hollander is wonderful. He is, mm-hmm. as they say, the titular character. So of course,
there you go.
And it's a new take on a sort of part that we've seen played by other actors and won Oscars and all of that. So yeah, I like it. It's good so far.
Great. I haven't watched it. I'm not opposed to watching it. But I'm also not rushing.
Yes.
Okay, some things that we, if you want to see our thoughts on Casablanca, the film, boy, do we have an episode for you.
Yes.
So do check our archive for that. What is your favorite decade of American films?
Oh, I mean, I guess the 40s, maybe the 30s. I mean, the obvious answer that everybody gives is the 70s. And there are a lot of good movies in the 70s. But then you have to see things like The Empire Strikes Back, and whatever, which are good films, but like not my cup of tea. Like I want to see Bette Davis and Joan Crawford and all
sure, stuff. Sure.
So maybe 35 to 45 is actually my answer.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. That's a good answer. I mean, mine's probably similar. I think typically, like in the long game, I would say the 30s, but I've been doing a lot of 70s recently and have been really enjoying that. So of course, again, that's obvious. Maybe I'll say the most underrated decade is the 50s. I think people don't like to say that for some reason, but it is like maybe one of the best.
I mean, Douglas Sirk worked in the 50s, so there's one filmmaker we love.
There you go. Which 90s film would you like to see as a limited series?
Well, first of all, I'm against limited series. I feel like a lot of limited series are just padding things when it should have been like, maybe it's not 2 hours, maybe it's 3 hours, but I don't need 8 hours of it. But right. Let's rediscover you know, things that are based on books. And the one that came to me, and I don't know why, maybe I saw somebody say something about it recently, is the James Ivory film with Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson, The Remains of the Day. I know they made a miniseries of Howard's End and it wasn't good, but I think The Remains of the Day, I would want to see a little bit more of it because that movie is so economical, so beautifully rendered about the story of these two people, but also at the same time, it's telling you the story of Britain and at that mm-hmm. time in the mid 30s, right before the Second World War, and sort of like the politics of class and what the ruling class was trying to do. So I would like to explore a lot of that more. And I haven't read the book, so I don't know if that's in the book or not, but maybe they should bring Kazuo Ishiguro to write more about the characters that were not given center in the film while maintaining the central relationship of the two leads.
Yeah, I share your hesitation about limited series. Like, I wouldn't want to do a film that is then stretched out into a limited series because it's like, I feel like they would just make it worse.
Yeah.
So it would either need to be like you did, like a book that was trimmed that can then be a more faithful rendering, or something that has like an interesting world that you could like build lore into. So mine, I think my choice would be Strange Days.
Oh, wow. Good choice.
Yeah. Cause I think that could result in like, I don't know, just, that has just really good lore.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So it could be a limited series that's like not even about the people that are in the movie. You know what I mean?
Just set in the world. Yes.
Yeah. When was the moment each of you fell in love with cinema?
That's Wyatt, right? Hi, Wyatt.
Wyatt says hi. He says he already knows your answer, but he's curious if you have a second one.
So the answer that I gave on my Cate Blanchett podcast, Sundays with Cate, is when I saw Elizabeth. And I was very, I was young and impressionable. And I was like, who is this person? And at that time, I haven't seen a lot of movies and I hadn't seen a lot of actors. And I was like, I can't believe somebody can do this on screen. And just, I was entranced and enchanted. And that's a moment I remember. And it's like, I think that's like a good answer for that obsession with that podcast. But I don't know. I think I've always just was interested, you know, as a queer kid growing up where I, as far as I can remember, I knew I was gay, but I just knew that I need to keep it a secret for a little bit until I'm ready to like tell the world. I never felt any guilt about it. Or that I was bad or that I should be straight or whatever. All those other things that society sort of like demands of you. I'm just like, oh, you know, I'm this way and I like it, but I just need to keep it a secret. So in that secret world that I lived in, I just, you know, gravitated towards TV, obviously, because, you know, there was not a lot of cinemas in Khartoum, but there was a lot of TV and Egyptian soap operas. That was my first love. And again, it's like the world that it takes you in, the outsized emotions, all the things that you're keeping a secret, but is expressed in the soap opera, in melodrama, in camp, all of these, everything is big and huge and everything is very dramatic and bigger than life, and out there. It's not a secret, it's out there. So I think that's how I fell in love.
Yeah, that's a really good answer. Damn. Mine is not as good. mine like touches on some of the most horrifically American things. First of which is Disney princesses. I allegedly as a child would like watch Beauty and the Beast and then it would finish and then I would like rewind the VHS and like watch it again. Like I was indescribably obsessed with this movie for some reason.
I love it.
And then the first like theater going experience I had that I really remember was seeing Gone with the Wind, because that's my mom's favorite movie. And of course, like major asterisks on that film in general. But I think going to see it, like I grew up in Ohio and there's like this one downtown theater that's like very majestic and kind of, it's like very old school. And opulent. And so that I remember going to that because they had like a classic film summer series. And so she took me to that because she and like set it all up. I was like, this is my favorite film. I'm so excited. She like bought me Twizzlers. And then just see like how big that movie is.
Oh my
to
God.
A kid.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like just the scale of it and how long it was. You know, I'd never seen anything else like that. And so, yeah, that was a really good experience, like at the time, for what I was understood, you know?
Yeah, I love that answer. And, you know, don't apologize for Gone with the Wind. Yes, it's the story and whatever, but there is the thing that I was talking about, the outsized dramatics of Vivien Leigh and Hattie McDaniel and Olivia de Havilland. Like, come on, how come you not, you have to fall in love with all of
well,
that?
Well, yeah, and it's like all of these people working at kind of their peaks, really. I mean, yeah. I guess you could debate with Vivien Leigh whether Streetcar is her peak, but for me, well, it's always Scarlett.
Yeah, she has two peaks. People right. can have two, more than one peak.
Yeah. So this person said just if like some words, but I think it's a good starting point, which is incurious audiences, studio era monopolization in the digital age, hyperbolic reviews / reaction. Thoughts.
Oh, wow. How do we talk about this? I think it's a lot. It's a beast that feeds itself. Mm-hmm. I'll talk about it from like a little bit of inside baseball, about, you know, critics and people who are, you know, working in media and why sort of like there is competition. A lot of our colleagues are not paid for what they do. A lot of them aren't. Only few people are paid. We're all fighting for access. We're all fighting this dwindling career opportunities. And so being first, being the one who has the reaction that is shared around, that is read by the filmmakers or, you know, whatever, or an editor who then reads it and be like, do you want to review the film? Or do you want to come on my podcast to talk about the film? That is how a lot of people get jobs. So,
yeah.
So, or opportunities in a lot of cases, it's not jobs. It's just opportunities to do something. And so that's why people want to be first. That's why people do the hyperbolic thing. So I just answered that part of the equation. Yeah. And it's all like a beast that feeds itself. Everybody's feeding the other. Like those people, my colleagues and our colleagues are feeding the studios, are feeding the whatever, the streaming, the all of that. So, so why don't you answer another part of that equation?
I don't. Oh gosh, I think the monopolization is the saddest part for me. It's strange because I feel like. So when before the studios were constrained by the Paramount decrees, which was like the last time there was kind of a vertical monopoly mm-hmm. of the industry, there was still a level of like artistry that I feel isn't being replicated. Like you could, like the producers who were working for these companies were not Wall Street guys. They were mm-hmm. they were controlled by Wall Street guys, but they still invested artistic. In like art making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that is what is really shameful to me is like that layer of protection for filmmakers where you have people in like company corporate positions who are still looking out for you as an artist or like interested in prestige as an actual measurable valuable mm-hmm. thing just like kind of don't exist as much anymore, or it's yep. like harder and harder to do that given how expensive films are and the fact that they need to make back like millions and millions of dollars to even mm-hmm. be worth it.
Yeah,
you're like not allowed to fail, which has always been true, but I think like the scale is just so much greater now.
Yeah.
So I just feel like the monopolization of it this time around is sort of like even harder to digest and like uh-huh. allows for yeah. even less freedom than the first time around.
Yeah.
And it's horrible.
Yeah.
It makes me really sad.
I hear you, but I'm going to counter with an optimistic view, and it's not my view, but it's two people in the industry that I heard speak recently. At Sundance, they did this panel with a lot of people, including Richard Linklater, who said that when he came to Sundance 40 years ago for the first time, or however long it was, maybe I'm aging him, maybe it was 30, there were maybe 200 films that were submitted and that were chosen from. That was the pool. Mm-hmm. And then he said that he heard that this year there were more than 14,000 submissions to Sundance.
Yeah.
That, of course, includes narrative documentaries, shorts from all over the world. But imagine in the last 35 to 40 years, submissions at Sundance go from 200, 250 to 14,000.
Mm-hmm.
That means a lot more people are making films. A lot of it will never see an audience, and a lot of it is terrible, but there is movies that are being made. And I think despite the monopoly, hopefully the good ones will come out somehow. And so there is hope, like at least people are making them. And then let's see what happens after that.
Well, I think like the difference is there are two things kind of fighting against each other, which is like one is the democratization of tools.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier than ever to get like a decent camera and microphone to like make something.
Mm-hmm.
But then like the limiting of distribution and like, mm-hmm. because even though you can put it online, it's like the likelihood that it does anything is kind of low.
Yeah.
You know?
Fair, absolutely.
So it's like those things are kind of in tension with each other.
But people are making them. So that's the optimistic view. And then the other one, I was just listening to Samantha Morton was given the BAFTA Fellowship, and I listened to her speech, or I think maybe it was a question after. And she said something about this is, I'm paraphrasing here, it's something about like, this is a time of change, and change is always difficult, and we don't know where we're going to settle, basically, like where this will end and what it is. And that sort of also makes me a little bit optimistic, because when TV came in the 50s, people thought cinema was going to die, and it didn't.
Oh, yeah. People think it's going to die every 3 minutes.
Exactly. So
even with AI, I don't think it's going to die, because ultimately, like I think art making is the only genuinely good thing humanity has done.
Yeah, totally. Right. Like,
and it's also like one of the, I don't think anything can stop people from wanting to express themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's, you can only really do so much with AI.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't think it's going to ever stop people from wanting to act, or like mm-hmm. stop people from wanting to write music, or, you know, build something. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Like that is so innate, and like people need to be able to have a venue to express it. And like, I don't think AI is like even capable of doing that, even in its ideal form and like the weird dystopian ways everyone wants to use it.
So hope springs eternal.
Easier question: who should be Sofia Coppola's next muse?
Wow. So who is her first muse? Is it Kirsten Dunst? Well, I don't know. You're the Sophia expert. I think this question is for you.
Well, I want to refute the, well, maybe not, not to say I don't want to like answer the question exactly, but I kind of don't. The thing is, I want her to like move on. You know what I mean? Like, as much as I want to see her keep working with Kirsten Dunst and stuff, I'm like, I would love, or maybe Kirsten Dunst, I want to see her work with again, because I want to see her make more things about like adults and explore like sophisticated womanhood. I think she's been focused on characters who are kind of like proxies for herself.
For herself as a teenager. Yeah.
Yes. And like the one time she kind of broke out of that with Somewhere and Bling Ring and
I don't know, Somewhere seems to me like that was about her when she was like 12.
When she was little. Yeah. But I think like it's mostly focused on the dad. And then was the other one? Oh, On the Rocks. It's like about an old, like a middle-aged woman. And it like wasn't very successful. So I would be really curious to see what she can do with like alternate visions of womanhood, like whether that means like a non-white actor or
I wouldn't ask her to do that. Like, it's better. She knows she does.
She kind of did it with On the Rocks. Like,
yeah, like, but Rashida Jones. Yes, she's not a white woman. She's a black woman, but she's also the daughter of a world famous artist, just like her. So.
It's sort of like, it's like, like she found like the exactly closest version to herself that she could.
Yeah, totally.
And then, so I want that. Or like, even if she wanted to do something that's like femininity that is not feminine. So it's like get Kristen Stewart. Do you know what I mean? Like, other visions of womanhood is where I want her to go.
Totally. Somebody, what older women? Ellen
Yeah.
Burstyn. You know, why don't you collaborate with Ellen Burstyn? And is it Bernstein or Burstyn? Wonderful actor in her 80s now. I think she's almost 90. She's still working. Do explore older age, Sophia.
Well, here's the thing is like I think she can do it if she if like if she's kind of unable to like make a film that is not in some way an analogy for her own life, which is like the Coppola story. That's how both of them are. Then I think like she has to be going through something with her own mother, like at her mother's current age, that I think would be really interesting. Because for Priscilla, she talks about like we all see it as talking about herself, but I also see it, and the way that she's talked about it is like the way that her mother felt being around her dad all the time, and just kind of being shut down as her own creative pursuits were just shut down because she was around this like titanic man all the time. And so like I'm sure that's still the case now, or like thinking about when her mom made her first movie at like I don't even know 70 or 80 years old. That's crazy. What is that like? You know what I mean?
That's a
There's
great
so many
story right
things.
there.
Yeah. Will Lily get a second chance at the podium given Stone's second win looks inevitable now? Does it look inevitable now?
I mean,
Yeah.
people I think are just reacting. Sorry to this person. I don't think it's inevitable. And I think it's just because she won the BAFTA. She basically, Emma Stone hasn't lost. Whenever she's been up against five other women, she has won because the Golden Globe where Lily won two, they were not up against each other.
Yeah.
She has won against Lily and she has won against everybody who's been nominated. But that's also what Cate Blanchett did last year and didn't win the Oscar. So until the SAG actually goes to Emma, I don't think she's winning. I don't think it's inevitable. Lily was not at BAFTA. She wasn't even nominated. So the only person who could have maybe won there is Sandra Huller, but it's like whatever. Poor Things is a British movie made there about a British, based on a British book. Everybody who worked on it, except for Yorgos Lanthimos and Emma Stone and the actors, was British. Like it was shot in England. People, so I'm not surprised it won five BAFTAs or whatever. It's a local industry movie. And so I don't think it's inevitable that she's gonna win. And yeah, I mean, Lily has managed this campaign very well. I think that she's going to be able to create opportunities for herself. And let's look at Viola Davis. Like I think that's a good example of somebody when she did the help, she refused to be campaign and supporting. She said, "I'm a leading lady, campaign me in lead, and I will win the Oscar or whatever." She didn't win. But then her career skyrocketed. She became a TV star. She's, you know, a decade later, she's still working. She is making movies that are box office hits and movies that are critically acclaimed, working on stage, doing whatever it is she wants to do. So I think that's the blueprint for Lily Gladstone.
Yeah, I was really excited to see her announced for The Memory Police. I really liked that book. So that was encouraging to me because one thing that wasn't encouraging to me about Michelle Yeoh's win was that the things that were announced for her immediately after her Oscar felt really similar to stuff that she'd already kind of been doing, where it's like Disney Plus show where you're like secretly really good at martial arts. You know what I mean? It just felt like a lot of the same. Whereas like Lil, that's a huge book and I think a pretty big production. So it does sound like she's getting kind of thrown back into the prestige drama circle pretty quickly.
Yeah, and the thing that Lily also has is youth. She is younger than when Viola Davis got got the help, and she's younger, obviously, than much younger than Michelle Yeoh. So the thing that I think trumps opportunities for Black and Brown women is ageism. And that's just for all women, yeah. which sort of like, so I guess that's why, that's my answer to why Michelle Yeoh maybe didn't get, but I think Lily will. And actually, I'm going to do the next question because I think it's related to this, the Meryl Streep question. Darcy Asian, I think. Asian. Sorry if I'm saying that name incorrectly. Anyway, what is going on with Meryl Streep's career? Has ageism come for the untouchable? I love that question.
That's so funny. I have no insight into this whatsoever, but this is just like a sense that I'm completely speculating about, is that I think she's just doing whatever she wants to do.
Yeah.
I'm sure that she's not short of offers, but I think she just kind of like wants to have fun. And it seems like she's having the time of her life on Only Murders in the Building, you know?
Yeah, she's hanging out with her friends and doing shows and being funny. And yeah, I mean, Meryl Streep, if she wants to do something, I think somebody will offer her a role, and think I'm sure she gets offers. And you know, she still can do the long day's journey into night, or the equivalents of those, which are still made. It's not like people stop making those. I'm not saying stage, but you know, there are movies like that being made.
I just have is if I were her, I'd be doing the exact same thing. Proved yourself, got all of your flowers, nobody doubts your talent. Why would you? I would be like, I'm gonna do a fun little show with my friends. That's it.
Yeah. This is the longest time in her career that she has gone without an Oscar nomination. So Meryl fans, yes, there is cause to worry, but I think it's not about opportunities. It's about what Izzy said. It's just what she wants to do.
Yeah. I would like to see her do, you know what? I would love to see her come back to the stage, which is a huge like undertaking. So again, I don't know that I would do it if I were like that secure in my life.
Probably not. Like, why would Meryl Streep want to do 8 shows a week?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like she's always talked about it. Like, oh, coming back to the stage, it's where I started. It's very like Natalie Portman in May December. Oh, I've always wanted to be on the stage. Anyway, please give general thoughts on The Curse and its ending.
Wow, we were going to do an episode on The Curse, but I don't think I have it in me to talk about The Curse for like 45 minutes. I liked The Curse and I hated the last episode. I think that's the
you did.
That's the sort of like gist of it for me. What about you?
Wow. The last episode like made it for me. I loved the last episode.
All right. Okay. So this is interesting. Tell me why.
Yeah. I just thought it was so wild and audacious, and I haven't seen anything like that on TV in so long. And it was just, it was so inexplicable that I was in love with it. Like how bold that choice was.
Yes, I agree that the choice was very bold. And for it to be wild and audacious, it did have to be a full episode of just that.
Yeah.
Because if it was just one scene, it would not have had the same effect. But I felt like it's a joke, and a joke should not be 40 minutes long. So I get what you're saying, that it's wild, it's audacious. And I understand they had to make it an episode. It's a TV show. Otherwise, it won't have the effect that they obviously got. That people, you know, they wanted this thing of like you liking it, me hating it. Like that's what you want if you're doing a work of art. Like you don't want everybody.
And
to
I
say
totally understand hating it.
Yeah,
I will. This is one of those things where I'm like, oh, for sure, people are gonna hate this.
Yes, it was just too long, and I was like, to what end? Like I was just like, what are we watching here? And yeah, and I don't want, you know, there's series and people like an explainer of the last episode, but I think it's a joke. There is no explainer. To me, there is no explainer.
Yeah, you don't need to explain it.
Like you just take it as it is, and whether you either like it or you don't, but there is no explainer. Like, what are we going to explain the laws of gravity? Like, what are we doing? There's no explainer.
Right. Yeah. There was maybe like 10, like 30 seconds. And when he first woke up, where they're like, oh, it's probably the pressure from the systems we put in, where I literally Googled. I'm like, is that possible? Like, I was like, really? That's so crazy. crazy. And then I realized what was happening and I felt really dumb, but I thought it was great.
You know what I loved about that episode is the look on Emma Stone's face after she gives birth and somebody asks her about the husband, and she's just like, she
It's
completely
like,
forgot
whatever.
about him.
I mean, her character is, I think, one of the best written characters on TV in a long time.
Yes.
I
And
mean, what a
she,
monster, truly.
total monster. And she really acted the shit out of that role. Like
Yeah, she did.
she was
That
mesmerizing.
whole begin. Did you like the beginning of the episode where they were on Rachael Ray? I was so obsessed with that.
I mean, it's yes, because the way that I thought that was very funny. First of all, Rachael Ray hated them, which was very funny.
Yes.
And then the fact that she's just trying to do what she was told, or and he is just there, plastic smile, didn't say a word. The whole thing was very funny, and it sort of
Yeah.
encapsulated their relationship and sort of how people might see them if you actually watch Green Queen or whatever that show is called,
Yeah,
which
just
you would be
the
like Rachael
idea that
Ray.
like yeah, the idea that like even Rachael Ray would be like contemptuous of them in an interview
Yes.
is
It
so funny.
is funny. That was the best part of the episode.
Oh man, that made me laugh so much. Two more? How does that sound?
Yeah, that
One
sounds
more?
good. Two, let's do two more. And thank you to everyone who sent questions, but I think we're
Yes.
coming on time.
Expectations about Megalopolis.
I'm gonna watch it, I think.
Same. I think my expectations are kind of low, if I'm being honest.
Yeah. I mean, when was the last time Francis Ford Coppola made a movie that everybody loved?
Well, I feel like that needs some, I don't know, reframing because I feel like a lot of people didn't like movies that are actually pretty good just because he was kind of in a flop era. Like Rumblefish is really good,
Rumblefish is amazing. That would be my
but
answer.
everybody hated Rumblefish.
I
I
even liked
think
the one with Richard Gere, The Cotton Club. I thought that was interesting.
I feel like some of his greatest work was made under a lot of constraints that he complained about a lot. And so I'm really curious to see what this like 30-year project with like limited constraints will result in. I can't imagine that it's good. I feel like he
Yeah.
probably went changed his mind on a lot of things a lot and had to redo things. And it's
Also,
just gonna be too big.
if it's a script that was written that many years ago, from what I understand, right? Like it was written
Yeah.
30 years ago or something like that, would it feel of that time? Like would it be like a something of like as if it was made in the 90s? Like
Well,
or
he started conceiving of this in the 80s. And I
yeah.
don't think like finished a script until like I don't even know when, but I don't think
Yeah.
there was a script until the 90s.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I actually my expectations are high for one reason, is that I think it will be interesting, and I think you and I are going to have fun talking about it, and both of us are going to have fun talking
Yeah.
about it to everyone else. So
Totally.
from
And you
that
know what?
perspective,
I'm super excited to see what he can do with Aubrey Plaza.
yeah, let's go. That the casting is pretty
Yeah.
interesting. You know, Shia LaBeouf is in it too.
Oh, yeah.
Who is a terrible person but a good actor?
Good
Like,
actor, though.
yeah.
Yeah. Sad. Okay. And last question. If you were going to create a new Oscar category, what would it be?
Well, I like the best newcomer, which is the César and the BAFTA. And the BAFTA sort of like gives them a different color statuette. Like they give them green, but I won't trust the public to vote on it. So maybe it should be I think BAFTA does a committee chooses the nominees and then the public votes for the winner. And this year, Mia McKenna-Bruce, who I loved in How to Have Sex, won, which I was surprised to because usually like the biggest name wins, and in this case, it was Jacob Elordi. But like people like Emma Stone and Florence Pugh and Gugu Mbatha-Raw and Daniel Kaluuya and Andrew, what is his name? Andrew Garfield. All of these people were nominated for Best Newcomer at the time when very few people knew who they were. And so it is it proves that that category is very good. I'm not as versed in the César one, but I know, for instance, Tahar Rahim won it. Amazing actor. The only person I can think of won that at the César. So why not? And it could be a different statue because people, maybe they don't want to give you an Oscar just because, hey, you started your career well. Yeah, make it a different looking thing. It could be a less, like, you know, not the juvenile Oscar exactly.
Yeah, that's
something
what I was
like that.
Yeah, it's weird that they just kind of like stopped doing that. The juvenile one. Like, what? I actually haven't looked into that. I don't know why they stopped,
yeah.
But.
Maybe there's a video there.
True. The people are clamoring for it. I'm going to give a weirdly niche one, but mine would be editing for a documentary. Because
I love that.
That is a completely different art form. Like the idea of editing a narrative where you kind of have a skeleton of what you're supposed to be making is 100% different than like getting 100 hours of raw footage and building something out of it. That's a
absolutely
completely different thing. And
yeah.
they get absolutely no credit for it. And that's so annoying to me. Because I've seen like in jobs that I've worked before, just handing over raw footage to people and seeing what they make out of it and seeing how much talent and hard work that requires. Like, it's such a specific skill set. And I wish they got more attention for it. But
you know
there are
what?
Like so many categories that I'd want.
Yeah, I'm dropping my best newcomer because actors get enough praise as it is.
Yeah.
And I'm joining your because editing for,
Thank
I think
you.
That's a brilliant choice. And
Thank
you're
you.
right, just for all the reasons you just explained. I think they should just do it right away.
Yeah. That's a good, I'm happy about the casting one, although I'm sure that's just going to turn into like best ensemble.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And then they should do, I would love a voiceover one. Like
voiceover
animated
performance. Yeah. Yeah.
Although I do think that would encourage like the worst decisions, a la Chris Pratt playing Garfield.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, the thing is, once there is an award, the behavior changes. Like, I'm sort of like interested to see. I don't think casting or the job of casting is going to change, but I'm interested to see like what's going to, you know, who's going to campaign for that and how they're going to campaign for it and what stories they're going to tell. Because it's a story in the end. Vote for me because I did this, this, and that, and I accomplished this, this, and that. It's a story that you convince people of.
Yeah, totally. And then stunts should be one.
I mean, yeah, that's the obvious one. They should have already done that.
For
yes.
sure. But yeah, I like the best documentary editor because it's so like, it is one of those things where it's like, that's not going to change. Like it, that
yeah.
it just is what it is.
Yeah,
and you
totally.
can't, anyway.
Yes.
Yeah, that's about it.
Well, thank you to everyone who sent us questions. This has been so much fun to listen from you. And these questions have been amazing. I love our listeners. They're obviously engaged and lovely, amazing people, smart. We will, I think, do one more episode before the Oscars where maybe we do some predictions next week. So,
Oh God. Yeah, they're so soon, huh? That's crazy.
Yes. So get ready. Tell us your predictions. And if you have Oscar questions, send them our way. And until then, you can find the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at I Am Picture Show. I'm on Instagram at Mortada_E and on Twitter at ME_Says.
And I'm BK Rewind on Twitter and BK_Rewind on Instagram.
And until next time, thank you for listening.